November, I had the great opportunity of interviewing Pat Capone. Pat is a Canadian author and advocate for issues around poverty and mental health. She is a lead facilitator with Voices from the Street and a steering committee member of 25 and 5. Her works include Dispatches from the Poverty Line and Beyond the Crazy House, as well as three other nonfiction novels and two mystery novels. What follows is the conversation that Pat and I had regarding her perspective on the issues of homelessness.
Thanks, Pat, for joining me here today for my podcast.
Pleasure.
So maybe if we could just start off, if you could introduce yourself and just tell people a little bit about yourself.
Okay, my name is Pat Capone, and I'm the lead facilitator with the group called Voices from the Street. I'm a psychiatric survivor, I guess 30 years of advocacy in Toronto. Getting better all the time, of course. I also wrote 7 books, 5 nonfiction on poverty, cops, and mental illness, and 2 current mysteries out there. The others can be found in the libraries, but current mysteries are set in Parkdale in a rooming house that mirrors the boarding house where I was sent in 1979. 70 crazy folks all cooped up together in a falling down building. So that's me.
Great. And what was the name of that book?
Oh, that's great. Like competing with millions of others.
Yeah. And how often would you write that blog?
Often, I think.
Yeah.
As, you know, not when there's nothing to say, because that's a bit of a bummer. But, God, there's so much going on. There's so much... I'm thinking actually about leadership after that Kingston rant in, which was very nice actually. I didn't find it a rant in. I'm really thinking of trying to put together some kind of handbook on if you choose to engage, here's some ways to go about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a leadership blog that might attract other people who are, I guess, centrist. Like, I don't know. I think, I don't know what I am. But clearly I'm not that far left, and clearly I'm not that far right. So that probably makes me sick.
Yeah.
So for people who are coming at it from that, and for others who might consider coming at it from that way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe on leadership.
Yeah. That's great. And the Kingston Rent, and that was the poverty conference that I saw you speak at.
Yeah.
That was really great. Your talk was really inspiring. And
it was fun. I really, I thought I would be like, the quietest voice in the place, but it was very, I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, you had a really positive energy, and I even noticed that you had some people crying, actually, in the audience, because there was so much positivity that came from you, which is sometimes hard to find in this kind of work, especially around homelessness and poverty.
Yeah.
People
yeah,
get really drained,
sure.
And there's not much movement.
And angry. And
so how do you maintain that?
I don't know, truly, because... I think maybe once I get over the shock of something bad again, like Toronto election, once, like for 4 days or so, I'll be sunk. You're just sunk. And then you see something, or because of the work I do, which I really love. Leaders can't be depressed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, not that I'm putting it on either, because when I go out to speak, I don't know how I got there. But for a depressive, I am remarkably upbeat at times, and I do believe in the power to change, and I also, at my advanced age, have seen people come and go, you know, strutters on the stage who don't last for very long. Look, when Nixon got elected with a large majority, and then he just, boom, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, the Turks in the States, Newt Gingrich, strutted up and was going to do evil stuff, and then he was outed as a creepo of the First Order, having an affair while his wife was dying. You know, little things like that.
Yeah.
So you see, and oddly enough, people like Richard Nixon contributing to the fall of the Berlin Wall. So you never know.
Right.
So it gives me some equanimity, which I can't pronounce. It gives me some balance and some thought that. You never know.
And when did you first get involved in work regarding poverty?
Mostly I was like, as a psych survivor, fighting for our rights and feeling much like agencies do, that my cause was the cause and our people were the sufferer of all sufferers, which had some validity. But when I was going across Canada to do a book on poverty and asked people that I met, poor people, simply poor people, people without the added label of disability, psychiatric disability, physical disability, how they felt, and it mirrored totally how crazy people feel, depressed, anxious, super vigilant, isolated, mm-hmm. You know, hopeless, dreamless. And I started to realize that that stuff affecting us wasn't due to mental illness then. Because if these guys who weren't suffering from an identifiable mental illness, they were suffering from poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to... So you're going to ask me when? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Probably... Well, my second book, mm-hmm. Dispatches from the Poverty mm-hmm. Line.
Yeah.
And the other one was called The War at Home. That's where I was sent to look at inner city poverty. So the writings were there, although the heart was still with the survival movement.
Right. Maybe if you could tell us a little bit more about some of the projects that have been most dear to your heart regarding poverty or homelessness.
Voices from the Street, it has been remarkable. We started, this was my learning, because you've got to keep learning and certainly learn from the people you work with. So the first group of voices was all survivors. And because we're such an insular community, nose to the belly button, and kind of give ourselves too much leeway in terms of behavior and how we treat one another often. When you've been treated as a kid, you act like a kid, when people are constantly intervening in your behavior, you give up on checking. So the first group was fractious, like it still was really good group, and we felt all cool about it, but I couldn't leave them alone in a room without arguments breaking out or hurt feelings somewhere, or Jesus, eh? So the second group, we put in people with mental illness and people with addictions,
mm-hmm.
brought the conversation up.
Mm.
People behaved a lot better because, I don't know why, I think because they were opening themselves up. This last group, which we're bringing back on the 11th, the People's Blueprint panel,
right,
the one that we brought and gave voices training to, and then they learned peer research, not from me, but from my partners in this, Mike Oliphant and Richard Matten. They are from the research division.
Mm-hmm.
So they taught them how to do peer research. The group came up with the questions that they wanted to do. We bought them each a video camera and sent them back to their communities. And now we are looking at hundreds of videotapes and applying. And we have a job application going out for an editor. Video editor. It's amazing stuff. It's so putting them together in a room, with the principles of leadership, such as first teach people that this is different, because these people are carrying, you know, 100,000 agencies and institutions on their backs,
mm-hmm.
so that this is different. It's only us here, people with lived experience. Then to move to immediately speaking on poverty. So they hear each other, they start to feel differently about who they are.
Yeah.
Because they can, you know, you're like me and I admire you, so what right. does this mean about me, right? Get them to experience their own expertise so that we would have newcomers, for instance, in this group, teach other people around the table about what does it mean and what are the hardships and, you know, barriers and obstacles, and then put people, single moms, together to talk about that. And then at the same time, while they're teaching, taking questions that are hard questions sometimes, not mm-hmm. mean-spirited, but hard, which they need to do because, you know, they're going to be out there speaking and people will. And sometimes if you voice what you think people are thinking, it's, it gives people... I used to declare an amnesty, but you don't have to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
So to get to feel that, and I just completed a TCHC group that was formed by two graduates of Voices from the Street,
mm-hmm.
One of whom, Mike Creek, works as our coordinator, and the other, Linda Coltman, amazing woman who had to undergo transplant, kidney transplant, while in a shelter.
Wow.
And became kind of a poster child for transplants, still in a shelter. So she's an amazing woman. So they went to TCHC and formed this group and got some bread to do it. And so I did the first 6 weeks with these guys and just was blown away again, you know. Mm-hmm. Just moving them, because from a point where they just mimic staff, oh, all tenants here are terrible, nobody cares about it. Mm-hmm. Getting them to the point after 6 weeks where it was simply by saying, okay, nobody's allowed to criticize tenants for the first 3 days. Let's see what we can say when we're not. So just changing their headspace, getting mm-hmm. them to listen again to one another, talk about how they felt when they first came here. Anyway, it was brilliant. So
wow.
They just graduated. We had a little celebration yesterday, and it just... So it's like I get to form new leaders. Mm-hmm. I get to be like a... And I told Mike and Linda Coltman, now you know how I feel. It's like being a midwife. It's a wonderful feeling.
Wow. It sounds really empowering all the way around.
Actually. Oh, totally. Yeah. Totally. I'm very lucky.
Yeah, that's really wonderful work. Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Funded by capitalists like Atkins.
Right.
You know, and Metcalf Foundation, like that is stunning too, and that sends messages, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah.
So you've done a lot of work, and you've been involved in the field for a long time, and you've been in Toronto.
Yeah.
So, what sorts of changes have you seen over the years?
In mental health, a whole lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, a whole lot, which is really nice, and I think that's what I gave me permission to move. Not out of that, because I always identify as a sex survivor, but not concentrating solely on psychiatric issues. But I'm preaching to them that it's time, not just for us, but for anyone who's been segmented by government and agencies, you know, that they only take care of this. You know, mm-hmm. your left hand goes here, your right hand goes there, your legs go there.
Yeah.
Pull down those silos and look at each other and see the similarities here and understand that things that happen to you are systemic issues experienced by anyone who's been poor, anyone who's living poor. That to me that's the issue I want to get across. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be, you know, with HouseLink, which was another group that I did, tenants and staff, you know, to start looking at each other as equals, which is no mm-hmm. mean feat, I'll tell you, and using a much broader lens than the narrow lens of psychiatry.
Yeah.
Get them thinking about how can they impact poverty mm-hmm. amongst the 500 tenants they have across. So you can do that by not outsourcing work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do a check-in with your tenants, see what skills and abilities they have, and utilize them.
Mm.
You know, for carpentry, for website production, there's some incredible talent there.
Yeah.
Teach people skills, hire to do the work there, frontline work, and any work, actually. And this is gaining acceptance there. So we have these wedge places, that are pushing like the Christine Center, one of the things I'm most proud of,
mm-hmm.
Beginning, being a founding member of that, non-medical model crisis center. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And part of their philosophy that we agreed upon was, all else being equal, if you're crazy, you get the job there. It was the first time it was a positive.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of poverty, do you see the situation over the years getting worse or getting better?
There's more of us.
Mm-hmm.
You can't separate it out from the economy. I just knew, a couple of days ago I went and saw Inside Job, and that is like totally depressing.
Mm.
So you look at that, just they're talking in on CNN today, that review panel they've had on the economy is looking at moving the retirement age from 67 to 69 in the States. Right, and by the time people get there, there won't be. So it's... Then you see all these people that, according to Inside Job, and I think they're right, looted the country.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, still in the Obama administration,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, and you think, wow, we're luckier than the States, where I don't know what people do when they're, and there's so many of them, millions mm-hmm. and millions. So from that aspect, it's really bad.
Yeah.
From the aspect of speaking for people speaking for themselves, much, much, much better.
Yeah.
We were certainly empowered by joining up with the 25 and 5 because it gave us provincial scope as an organization. It ensured that we have like incredible contacts in the government and in places where, with people who are just people like John Stapleton, who's an amazing person. Atkinson has been so good. But, you know, we've been very, very lucky. Media, we have incredible contacts there. We're punching way out of our weight class, and that's because we joined up with others. So to an extent, that is the star on the horizon, right? That we're defining for ourselves. The really crappy part is the whole failure of the economy all around us. Our argument, of course, is this is the time to invest. And 25 and 5 is coming out with a big report card on the 1st of December or whatever the last day of November is, which I can't remember. So I'll put that on my Facebook page.
And so a lot of people working in the homelessness sector have share a common goal of working towards ending homelessness. Do you think that that's a possibility?
We were really stupid, though. You know, we used to be 2, 3, 4 people on the street. We could have dealt with that. We could have dealt with those guys. We just, it's like when there were 2 or 3 dealers on the street corner, could have dealt with them then. But we just, we never do. We wait till the dam breaks and, of course we can end homelessness.
Yeah. And in terms of support services for serving homeless people, do you think that that they're designed in such a way to actually provide support?
No. We have to be in there, and people with experience of homelessness who, not everybody can do it. Like, you can get broken by experiences, or you can get bitter, you can get hateful.
Yeah.
But if you come out with some degree of empathy and ability, then, you should be working there. There's things that academic-based staff can learn from us and that we can learn from them. But first, they have to stop thinking that their credentials make them experts, because it doesn't.
Yeah. So, as you know, the work that I do, a lot of my work involves LGBTQ youth homelessness and looking at the lack of support in Toronto. So, I know this isn't really your area of expertise, but maybe if we could just shift the focus and talk a little bit about that. I'm just curious about what you have to say. I'm wondering what your opinion is about what do you think are the top 3 reasons that youth become homeless?
One of the biggest reasons is abuse in the home, whether that's sexual, physical, emotional abuse. That's you know, we like to think, oh, they're just running away because they don't like the rules. That may be a child or two, but I actually worked with kids. I ran a group home for 4 years for Summerhill Homes in Montreal. I loved it. It was before, like, they had shifts every day, so we actually lived in and lived in with the kids, and it was home. It was like, it was really cool. I used to read the kids stories at night when they went to bed, and it was really cool. They were teenage kids, and 7 boys. I was too smart to have a house full of girls. And I had a really good time with these kids, but I think the first is emotional, physical, and whatever other sexual abuse. I think too, and this I wasn't aware of, but my coordinator at Voices, I went to stay Port Dover, I think it was, in Port Dover with him, at his mother's house while she was away. It was a pseudo vacation. The town, the experience of a small town, which I had a little bit of, but mostly I've lived in 2 really big cities all my life. And the fear of being outed as gay in that really fairly conservative community, and how that, so it's like being gay in a community that's not tolerant, where everybody knows your business, everybody, you know. I don't think I could have borne that, so I think that would put people on the road. for sure, to try and find a place where they could be free.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he left, you know.
Yeah.
That's why he left. Top three reasons. I would say those are the top two. I wouldn't even...
That's just fine. And do you think that Toronto is a safe city for LGBTQ youth who are homeless?
It's not safe for anyone who's homeless.
No.
No.
What do you think has to happen for it to become safer?
You gotta get rid of homelessness. Yeah. How can you be safe on the street? Like, you can't, right? And that... I remember... You know, I worked at a drop-in for 7 years in Parkdale, and the women who were left out on the street, well, what would they do? Well, they'd go with the nearest guy who could provide a bed for the night, eh?
Yeah.
And that does wonders for self-esteem and safety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that we have to get rid of homelessness.
Mm-hmm. And as you know, there is no emergency crisis shelter specifically for the LGBTQ youth population. And there's been a lot of talk about this. Do you think that Toronto would benefit from such a service?
I don't know. I'm very careful in terms of helping initiate new services that become really oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, my notion on this is... gay community in Toronto has got to step up. When you got kids, and you know the things that we've seen in the States are just getting increasingly appalling, but it happens here too, of course, right? Where kids in schools and are bullied, and at home, the same thing. So where are their mentors? Where, you know, the population, especially in Wesley Church area,
yeah,
gay community, right, situated there, is a very wealthy community.
Yeah.
Right? What do they call it? Two double income, no kids, stinks. And shame on them for not having some kind of crash pad, some place where kids could come when they're in transit. And where peer workers could just let them know what's out there, you know, that whole theory of that it gets better, it does. But Jesus, you got to survive first, right? And how do you do that? So I would like to see that this community do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, set up. It's not a big thing. It's not that hard. Could even be done on a almost like a fostering basis, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It would take some responsible people, but God, we have that for sure.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't start a separate service because it would quickly become probably psychiatrized, and you know, I don't know that you want to do that to people, but run by and for, I think it would be very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And a lot of services that exist have reported a lot of challenges in providing support to queer youth.
Yeah.
Saying that they're not really sure how, they don't understand the issues of homophobia fully or coming out and that sort of thing. So if you could offer some advice to these services on how they could become more queer friendly, what sort of advice would you provide?
I guess it's the same as other communities, like they call the psychiatric survivor community, and we get these labels, hard to house, hard to serve. Well, no, you just don't know what you're doing. So again, it's pairing up with people who have a lived experience, who can show them the ropes and help them to understand.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I think there are increasingly, like CAMH has a separate department there, but it's still hard to trust, eh, that mm-hmm. they actually, we were a social disease, right, were we not?
Mm-hmm.
It was a psychiatric illness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I still, I'm not ready to forgive that quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, I told you I worked in group home, which I did. One of the saddest, so this couple who are both social workers,
mm-hmm.
good social workers, which is rare. He, after his death, I learned this, he had tried to be cured from his gayness. doesn't just make you ill.
Yeah.
So he tried to be cured. He lived and he had kids with this other lady who knew about his struggle.
Yeah.
She encouraged him in the, you know, his late 70s, early 80s. She encouraged him to follow himself.
Right? Yeah.
You know, be true to himself.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't happy. So he actually tried. He stepped out, you know, and got in a relationship and killed himself in a public park. Just killed himself. And that makes me mental. Any kind of bullying like that,
yeah.
Any kind of... How awful is that? A very gentle, sweet guy who really cared about the kids, and we do stuff like that to people. It's just, it's... Oh.
And that's still happening today.
Oh, yeah. Like, Toronto feels safe to be who you are, right? When I go into other communities, I'm sometimes a bit taken aback. Like, people are very nice to me. In every speech, I put in that I'm gay. I work it in.
Yeah.
I work in that I'm Muslim. You know, just to try and catch all the bases. And I've never been hurt or anything. But then you see people who actually live there and who haven't had spokespeople, who haven't, you feel bad for those guys. You feel bad inside for them. The old style gay, when I first came here, you know, the way it was like, I don't know another way to put it, but when people were mostly in the closet, I met numerous, when I first came here 30 years ago, at KMH, homophobia ruled there too, but you'd meet people really, really nice, but in the stereotype roles, you know, that was quite funny. Sometimes when I would go into a gay bar, half the people would leave because they recognized me and were afraid I would out them. Right?
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite something.
Wow, so, I mean, in some ways it's definitely got better, obviously, homophobia,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's still
here,
really...
Here.
Yeah.
In big city.
Where, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you still see it as a problem here in the big city?
Not for me, but I live... I'm increasingly sure that I live in a really interesting bubble where... you know, if you look at what's happening in the state, I'm gay, that's already a bad thing. I'm Muslim, you know, which is a really bad thing. And, you know, so I think, geez, if I walked over to the United States, I'd probably get, you know, it's probably a crime being me. So here we just, there is some kind of bubble of acceptance and with an occasional not good, you can catch it. Some very hateful things at times. But that you hear that or you see that, so you know it's there.
Yeah.
And you really wonder, given permission, how much that would surface. But the other part of me believes in the intrinsic goodness of people. And,
You know, and there's this huge campaign that it gets better, and that's really spreading around.
It doesn't get better by itself. And that's kind of, if I was a kid undergoing a lot of pressure, that's helpful. But much more helpful would be action to, you know, teachers step up to make schools safe places and not abdicate their responsibility as adults in these places.
Yeah.
That makes me mental when we just abdicate more and more and more and leave kids to their own fate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so before we end off the interview, Pat, is there anything that I didn't ask you about that maybe you wanted to add in?
We're going to try and organize. We're going to organize. How good? I don't know. In March, our People's Blueprint panel that's been looking at issues of ODSP and welfare and how to do things right, we're going to have a big conference. And what we hope is to bring very disparate groups together in the room, bureaucrats, workers, all over, you know, 905ers, and just tell things that aren't usually heard and show the face of poverty. You know, don't leave that to the Fords of this world to define who people are. There are so many heroes out there who struggle every day, and you know, just things that I would give up, like totally give up, probably crawl under my bed and just give up, right? Mm-hmm. People with incredible challenges, hungry to work.
Yeah.
You know, to be seen as valuable members of society, to they'll be down here and they'll be talking. And, you know, we'll rip the lid off what poverty is and what people on social assistance, who are they?
Yeah.
You know, and get some basic respect for them and for cracking through these services and starting to say, hey, a lot of this we can do and we can do a lot better than you guys have done.
Hmm. And that's going to be March 2011?
God willing.
Yeah. Well, that sounds really great.
Yeah.
So I guess there will be some sort of...
big notices. Yeah,
big notices. Yeah. Okay.
We're getting funded for that, too.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know...
Yeah.
So it keeps you kind of optimistic.
For sure. Well, thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak with me.
It was lovely meeting you in Kingston.
Yes.
And I gather I turned you down once, but I, you know, much, much harder to do in person. And I appreciate the time and the effort you put in.
Great. Thank you.